Welcome to the Uphill Athlete Podcast. Our mission is to elevate and inspire all mountain athletes through education and celebration. My name is Alyssa Clark, and I will be your host today. I'm joined today by IFMGA guide and familiar voice, Steve, and a special guest, AMGA guide, Bill Allen. Bill is an AMGA ski guide, 2x7 summiter, and owner of the guiding company Mountain Trip. Thanks for joining both of you.
Thanks, Alyssa. It's great to be back.
Yeah, thanks.
Awesome. Yeah, and Bill is a guest from prior Uphill Athlete podcast episodes, kind of before Steve and I took control. So it's good to have you back, Bill.
Thanks.
So I'd love to hear more about your background, what drew you to the mountains, and particularly, you know, the high altitude mountains. Also, where and how long you've been guiding for?
Yeah, my sort of mountaineering experience and altitude experience really mostly started in Alaska. I grew up in Oregon, and so I played in the Cascade Mountains as a kid. But as I got, you know, out of college, I started going up to Alaska, getting into the mountains there, and then, you know, Denali was obviously the big draw up there, and that wasn't really what originally, you know, got me excited about it. But of course, you just want to continue to pursue the next big challenge or whatever, and especially as a guide, you know, Denali was a goal to get up there. So yeah, I started guiding on Denali for Mountain Trip when the original owner, the guy who started Mountain Trip, Gary Bocard, owned the company. And that was in the early mid-90s, I started guiding up there. And so, and that was, the beginning of my kind of big mountain and altitude experience was up there. And then from there, I was able to, you know, go do some other big expeditions and altitude expeditions, Aconcagua was one of them. And in terms of just pure altitude experience, I think that's a big one. And then, you know, continued around to the Seven Summits and all that, and been to Everest 3 times now. And yeah, still mostly guide in Colorado where I live, and then expeditions in Alaska, and then a variety of international expeditions occasionally still.
And my Denali guiding probably started about the same time as yours, Bill. Like I think my first trip was in a second guide for American Alpine Institute in 1992 with Doug Chabot. And we were on the mountain 24 days that trip, and we're stuck at 14 for 10 days, I think. And, you know, it was a interesting time, I think, to be up there. In hindsight, I mean, Peter Hackett, who we were just talking about a moment ago, was still up there doing research on and off. And, you know, guiding was, I mean, it's still hard, but I think it was really set the standard in terms of work ethic for all the other guiding I did in my career. Just the sheer amount of physical and mental and group dynamic and medical work you had to do for those trips. And a big part of it was the medical component, which of course is directly connected to the high altitude component of that mountain.
Yeah. You learn a lot up there about the workload of being a guide on Denali. Much less, you know, for the clients, it's massive amount of work, but being a guide up there, it's just huge to, you know, the climbing, the carrying the loads, the digging camps, the melting every drop of water you're going to drink for almost a month and all that. So yeah, pretty much everywhere you go after that, not that it's easy, but it's not Denali hard. You know?
Yeah.
Even Everest, honestly.
Well, this is more, I guess, just a general question of me not knowing a ton about guiding in Denali, but do you go in with one specific group to bring up, or do you kind of just get planted there and then take groups up from there? Is there kind of a standard?
No, we'll have a climbing team, and pretty much everybody does it this way, but you'll have a climbing team and you'll have the guides and clients meet. We meet everybody in Anchorage and then fly in, and yeah, we're a team up there. I think one of the differences that, like, from the 90s, like you were talking about, Steve, to now, is that we do more smaller guide teams now, climbing teams. And so you may have a team 3 days ahead of you and 2 days behind you, and every camp you may move into, there's another team there that has been there for a little while, and you can go in and fill up your water bottles in their kitchen and all that. And I feel like it used to be, we were more spread out and felt a little bit more on your own out there.
It's different. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, as I recall how we would run it with American Alpine was that the trips were spaced a week apart. Mm-hmm. So you were like, you'd be at 11 and somebody would be flying into base camp, or you might even be at 14, people would be flying into base camp. So, you know, obviously a week apart is a lot. You never have more than maximum three teams on the mountain at the time. You didn't really see each other that much. We didn't have caches, I mean, except our own. But the altitude on Denali, I think, is also really interesting because and I don't know about your experience, Bill, but I first heard about this on Denali is, like you, Denali was my first significant high altitude experiences. And I always heard like, oh yeah, you know, 6,000 meters on Denali is higher than 6,000 meters in Asia and these kinds of things. And you think, oh yeah, I don't know, that sounds funny. But I have to say, like, I actually think it's mostly true. Like, it is harder to acclimate above 4,000 meters or so on Denali in my experience and in the experience of my own guiding on Denali than it is in other places around the world.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty significant difference for sure. And I think it's part of what gets people in trouble, like coming from Colorado, where I live, where people can run up to 14,000 feet or, you know, for a day, go to the peak and then they come back down. But, and then taking that and thinking you can run up to 14,000 feet on Denali and getting up there and getting into trouble in a hurry. And it's the, you know, the difference between 14,000 here in Colorado and 14,000 in Denali is pretty significant. And then also just like spending the night and staying there is a big difference. People aren't sleeping at 14,000 feet on the top of a 14er in Colorado.
Yeah. Can you explain why it is different? I've also heard this before, but what makes it feel different than, say, 6,000 in Asia?
My understanding is that the atmosphere of the Earth is stretched at the equator because it's spinning, and so it's wider at the equator, so it's stretched at the poles, and so it's actually just thinner at the poles, and so your relative barometric pressure and therefore the available oxygen is lower as you get to the north and south pole.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think that what is certainly true is that there is just, like as we were saying, more work involved. And I think that one of the basic concepts that I try to pass along to people around acclimatization is that acclimatization is, let's say, a task that your body has to do, and it needs rest, it needs energy, it needs food, it needs all of the things that you need to complete any other physical task. And you're having to do that on top of a whole bunch of other work that you're often not accustomed to doing, like what we were just talking about. It's not just the carrying the loads, which is a massive amount of work. It's also sleeping on the glacier in a sleeping bag on a thermarest or whatever your pad is, like, you know, in a tent that rattles all night because it's windy, you know, being uncomfortable because it's really difficult to get up and urinate during the night. And, you know, you you sit up and you knock all the frost off the tent and it falls into your partner's face and you wake them up. And I mean, it's just sort of a veritable sort of, you know, comedy of circumstances that make living really tough up there. And so when you put all these factors together and you're eating, you know, substandard food, let's say, you know, I mean, you have to eat a lot of dehydrated food and other, you know, things. You're not, you know, so you're just not rested as well. You're not fueled as well. You're doing a ton more work. You're often under a lot of stress. People, I don't want to underestimate, people really beat themselves up mentally. And I'm sure, Bill, you have all kinds of experience with this. Like a lot of what I did as a guide up there was simply coaching people that they could do it, because they would have themselves talked out of it before they even got to 14 a lot of times. And it's purely in their heads. And that's a tremendous amount of stress that they're going through. And it's just like with training adaptations, it's just another acclimatization is just another adaptation your body is making to an environmental stress. And it takes resources. And those resources are scarce on Denali. They just are.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. Thank you both for that explanation. I think it's just, I've heard it before and was curious what your reasonings were. So I guess to go from there, what are a few mountains that have stood out to both of you from your guiding experience, particularly at like high altitude, and what has made them very memorable for you?
You know, for me, yeah, I mean, Mount Everest obviously is a big one on a lot of levels. And that was, you know, for me, that was the culmination of, you know, decades of guiding at 6,000 and 7,000 meters before I ever went to Mount Everest. But, you know, you learn a lot about altitude like we were talking about on Denali at 6,000 meters or on Aconcagua at 7,000 meters. You see you learn a lot about not just how you do, but how clients do and how to kind of manage that sort of extreme altitude.
Yeah, I never guided in the Himalaya personally. So all my experience with high altitude guiding was in South America and Alaska. And one of the places that was actually pretty formative for me is I did a lot of trips over about 4 or 5 seasons in Ecuador, really early in my guiding career. And those are actually great starter altitude experiences. I really recommend those climbs for a lot of people because I think they're, you know, they're accessible, they're very high. You get a lot of experience both as a guide and as a climber at, you know, these approaching and over 20,000 foot altitudes without all the commitment of a 21 day trip like, you know, Denali typically is. And, you know, and it's super beautiful down there. It's really, really gorgeous part of the world.
Is the success rate generally higher for Ecuador, like those types of trips compared to a Denali?
Oh yeah, much higher.
That's what I figured, but.
Yeah, I'd say the typical, I forget the statistics, Bill, you may know, but on Denali, it's typically around 60% of people on guided trips summit and typically around 40% of independent climbers summit on Denali. That's, as I recall, what the averages tend to be. They kind of tally them each season and they vary a little bit from year to year. And I would say, you know, we would do these Ecuador trips and we do Cayambe, Cotopaxi, and Chimborazo typically in a 15-day trip. And, you know, it seemed like everybody would summit at least one of the mountains. And, you know, a couple of people would summit all three, you know, out of a group of 10. And, you know, assuming weather was stable and those kinds of environmental factors. But, you know, that's a much higher success rate than the 60%.
Yeah. No, that's really good to know. I know a lot of our clients go down there first and then kind of move into Denali, etc.
Yeah. And if you only do coat epoxy, you know, I mean, you can just do some acclimatization hikes and coat epoxy and have a great trip in, you know, 9 days, you know, car to car kind of a thing, or jet to jet, as it were.
So, Steve, you touched on this of when you're on the mountain, of how a lot of it was just reassuring clients that they were capable of existing in the altitude and succeeding. But Bill, you know, when you're doing your pre-trip communications and such, how do you help clients who are concerned about the altitude when you're kind of in the pre-trip planning stage?
Yeah, it's really manage the things that you can, right? Like, there's a lot of people, you know, and not to keep going back to Denali, but that's what we do a lot of. And a lot of people, that's going to be the first time they're up to 20,000 feet. Like, maybe they've climbed throughout the US and maybe they haven't traveled to Ecuador or, you know, Argentina or wherever and gone to those higher altitudes. And so it's going to be the first time that they're above about 14,000 feet. And so, you know, controlling what you can, meaning be fit and strong and take care of that component of it and gain the other experiences so that the technical skills and the movement on the mountain is easy for you and that you've got that side of things. And so, there's things you can do to pre-acclimatize, obviously, now, which is great, like these hypoxico tents, and those are getting used more and more, not just by people who want to do like a quicker ascent, but just by people who are joining our trip and going on the normal schedule and the normal acclimatization plan, but they want to make it a little bit easier on themselves while they're on the mountain, or just relieve some of the anxiety about the altitude that they might have leading into it. And so, you know, there's things that people can do like that to prep, but really it's just like making sure that you're prepared in all the other ways, and don't worry about the altitude side of it, because we're going to design an acclimatization plan, an itinerary for moving up the mountain that's going to allow the vast majority of people to acclimatize. And, you know, you're going to feel altitude. You might have a headache and you might not feel great every day, but you're going to be able to acclimatize at that ascent rate. So.
Yeah. And the thing I would add to that, Bill, too, is that one of the universal experiences of altitude is that it's uncomfortable. And I think that people often get kind of psyched out because they get up there and they feel uncomfortable and the alarm bells go off because that's not normal. You know, climbing up to, as you said, 14,000 feet, you don't really feel, I mean, maybe that kind of uncomfortable like you do when you're sleeping above 14,000 feet for a week or sleeping at 17,000 feet the first time. I mean, it's just uncomfortable. And, you know, you're going to be really uncomfortable and not be sick most of the time, right? Like, and still be basically fine. It's like, it's your body under stress. It's doing its thing. The acclimatization is underway. But by definition, you're summiting on Denali or any of these high mountains well before you're acclimated to that altitude. You're on the edge of that envelope, right? You're acclimated enough to go there, but you're definitely not acclimated enough to stay there, especially when you get up above 6,000 meters. And so there's a real threshold in my experience that's different for different individuals. And for me, it's above 5,000 meters. This is uncomfortable now. I'm over 5,000 meters. And for me, there's another one at 7,000 where me personally, like when I transition above 7,000 meters, I'm like, okay, like that was a big step. It doesn't feel that much worse to me from 7 to 8 but from 5 to 7 is sort of the same sort of level of suck. And from 7 up is another kind of level. And it's just suffering. And, you know, it's just good old garden variety suffering. And as long as you can separate mentally what is the difference between the suffering and the illness and the what is dangerous,
which is hard to do. It's hard to stay objective when you're that uncomfortable. But experience brings that perspective. And that's where I think people who are new to high altitude get really psyched out, because they're just like, oh my God, like, I've never felt like this before. This has to be bad. Like, I'm, you know, and their brains, our brains are built to protect ourselves. Or, you know, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to die. I got to go down. It's like, no, you're not going to die. You're just going to have a headache, and you're going to feel like not good for a while. And then you're going to start to feel better. And then you're going to be able to, you know, feel like yourself again in a few days. And let's look at trends. Let's not focus on how you feel this moment. And I think that that's one of the things that I really, you know, with guiding and with being at altitude with people who haven't been there that much as climbers, just getting people to focus on the trends as to, are you trending worse or are you trending better? And not from minute to minute, but from, like, you know, half a day to half a day or from day to day. That's kind of the scale you need to look at.
No, that's really helpful for clients who are going into it. And yeah. So how do you say your client shows up, you're getting on the mountain, how are you assessing their preparedness to go into altitude?
Yeah, I mean, it's about pacing, I think, as much as anything else, you know. And it's like during the day when you're climbing, like not pushing people past where they're able to recover is super important, because it gets harder and harder for people to recover or catch up. After, if they're pushing too hard at altitude, people just don't recover. So just kind of keeping an eye on people during the day and make sure you're not pushing them too deep into their, you know, reserves. And then, like, on a more long-term basis, like the day-to-day thing, it's just, like Steve said, it's kind of keeping an eye on trends. And, you know, if you have a headache in the morning, like, that might feel, it might have been a terrible night's sleep and you wake up and you don't feel very good and you have a headache, but is that an okay headache, or is that like the onset of cerebral edema in a life-threatening situation? And, you know, most of the time it's going to be AMS, it's going to be acute mountain sickness. And that's something that is normal and to be expected. And it's hard for people their first time at altitude to gauge whether this is an okay normal headache or if this is something that's beyond normal. And there's a lot of anxiety around that for people. And I think for experience at altitude, I think as much as anything, is learning what's okay and what's normal for you. Like, if I wake up with a headache, I'm like, I'm fine. I'm going to go have a cup of coffee. And it's going to start getting better, you know, and as soon as I get up and I move, I know it's going to start feeling better. And if it didn't, then that's when I would start to be concerned. But knowing yourself and how you respond and what amount of suck is okay, and when you're kind of getting pushing beyond that.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that, Bill, and people have to kind of learn that and go through that themselves to believe it, right? Like, you kind of can tell them all the things ahead of time, but until they've gone through it and had that experience of waking up with a headache, getting out, shoveling a bit, having a coffee, whatever, moving around, have that feeling that you're feeling better through the morning. You know, I think that's something you just have to experience to really believe for yourself. The other thing that I think really helps people, frankly, is just fitness, just showing up fit, because again, your body will acclimatize to a certain extent at a rate at which it has available resources to dedicate to acclimatization. And if you're completely destroyed physically every day, I've never seen, you know, ostensibly fitness, like if you take an unfit and a fit individual and put them in a helicopter or something and flew them to higher altitudes, their acclimatization, rate of acclimatization does not change. It's not directly dependent on fitness per se, but it is in the sense of if you pull into that camp and you're destroyed versus you pull into that camp and you're a little tired, but you recover fine. The person who is a little tired and recover fine is clearly going to acclimatize better. So again, to Bill's point earlier, control what you can control and show up for the trip with a good aerobic base, because, you know, again, aerobic is so important at altitude because there's not much oxygen. So your ability to utilize oxygen is amplified. The importance of your ability to use oxygen is amplified at high altitude. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I was just going to say the one challenge that super fit athletic people have, I feel like, is pacing appropriately at altitude. Yeah. And that's something 100%. That can be scary on a mountain like Denali, where you can't just turn around and run downhill necessarily if you're not feeling good. And especially I feel like it's the Colorado, you know, super mountain athlete people who are used to running and putting in huge days and vertical and running up over 14,000 foot peaks. And then they come and to a mountain like Denali and they push up to 14,000 feet in 2 or 3 days and then get sick at 14. And sometimes it can be pretty bad and it can come on pretty fast. And so if they weren't fit, they wouldn't have been able to get there in the first place that fast, you know? So sometimes that gets them into trouble.
Yeah, that's totally true, Bill. And I mean, so many, you know, when I was, so many of my own expeditions, both in South America and Asia, you know, this is one of the reasons I really got into this mode of really seeking out objectives where I could do easy climbs in the beginning, like lower at lower elevations. For classic example, it'd be like in the Charcuso Valley, where you can literally like be bouldering in around base camp. And I think that kind of light exercise is really good and positive for your adaptation. And then you can hike a little higher. Then you can hike up to say 16,000 feet. And then you can do a rock climb that takes you up to a 15,000 foot summit. And then, you know, there's ways to sort of keep that type A personality engaged. And that also keeps that in check and doesn't, you know, because the problem is, as you say, you can potentially get up too high into a dangerous situation and be stuck and be sick. And that can definitely work against people. And there, it does take a certain amount of time. Like there's no shortcuts.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure that the mental component of assuredness, we'll say, confidence, can be quite detrimental at times.
Are you ready to achieve your mountaineering objectives and perform better at altitude? At Uphill Athlete, you can train your way with our field-tested, science-backed training programs. Choose from training plans, personal coaching, or the new Uphill Athlete training membership. Check out the link in the show notes and start training.
So how, when you have a client who's struggling at altitude, how do you help them to manage it? I think, Steve, you kind of spoke about this before, but yeah, Bill, I'm curious what your strategies are.
The first thing is just take care of the basics, like food and water and sleep, you know, like make sure people are staying hydrated and they're eating well and you're providing them with, you know, sometimes people struggle to eat at altitude for a variety of reasons, but like making sure that you're fueling them and getting them water. And then the sleep component is really challenging for some people who just struggle to sleep in a tent at sea level, much less, you know, at altitude and on a mountain. So, so that's a big one. And then it's time. It's so you can adjust the schedule and give people an extra day to rest and that sort of thing. And even, you know, like as Steve mentioned, when we're resting, like at 14,000 foot base camp or on Denali, like a rest day doesn't mean lay in your tent flat all day. It means like getting out and moving and getting some exercise and stimulating breathing and you know, making sure that you're doing stuff to stimulate your body, but not overdoing it. And so allowing yourself to kind of have an active recovery day. But usually if you give people a day or two and you make sure they're getting food and water, like it's amazing the difference that you'll see in 24 or 48 hours with somebody, as long as they're not, you know, at advanced stages of pulmonary edema or something like that, and they just have to go down. But you'll see, yeah, you'll see a major difference in just a couple of days of active rest and recovery.
I will emphasize what Bill said, just getting out of the tent, shoveling, fixing up your campsite, walking over to some neighbors and having a cup of tea. You know, I think that it's taking pictures, just getting up and out most of the time, is the first step. One of the worst things, you know, you can do is just stay in your tent and stay in your sleeping bag and lay there. It's really tough mentally. And I think that it's not good to physically, in my experience, to have people just sort of stay in their tent and isolate. They don't do well in that scenario. And that is an inclination. And it's an inclination for me and for a lot of people when you're not feeling well. So it helps to have other humans around you to encourage and support you to get up and get out and just do something and move. And, you know, it's one of the kind of fun things, frankly, about high altitude climbing is you do often share a lot of camps with other people that you would normally not have met. And so there's a huge social component, whether it's Aconcagua or Denali or Everest or any other 8,000 meter peak, you know, it's actually a huge social component just to kind of get to know people around. And they're from all different countries and all different backgrounds. And it's often super fun. So, you know, that's a good side of it.
Nice. Yeah, that's great advice. So this is a question that personally I'm really interested in. So maybe this is more for me than anything else, but how do you balance your own safety, your client's safety, and then assessing, you know, is it right to continue forward? Should we turn around? And what happens if you start having difficulty out there?
Yeah, I mean, that's super important. As a guide, you're responsible for everyone on the team. And so you need to make sure that you're solid before, you know, being able to push up higher or anything like that. And so, you know, in terms of just acclimatizing, in terms of the altitude side of things, I think that just comes down to having the experience to know what works for you and how to take care of yourself and how to make sure that you're acclimatizing well. And then also just like not being afraid to say, hey, I'm not there today and I'm not willing to lead you guys up higher today. And I'm glad you're all feeling great, but I'm not. And we're going to take another day, you know, type of thing. So, yeah, I mean, it obviously the guides need to be solid, and that, you know, that's all the things we talked about. That's fitness, that's experience at altitude and knowing what works for you and what doesn't and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. And I would also say that the guiding team is really important. Like those are the people that as a guide, you are relying on to check in on you and you're checking in on them, you know, and you're, and that becomes second nature to any experienced mountain guide, but you know, you are one another's support and you have to be super honest with each other because we do get sick too. And you know, every time I go to altitude, my body is reacting slightly differently. Like I am pretty, I've been to high altitudes lots and lots and lots of times, but it's still always a little bit different. And I've also had experiences where I went to 7,000 meters and got full blown pulmonary edema. And, you know, then the next season gone and climbed higher altitudes and felt completely fine. We're not entirely clear on why these things happen to people, why people get sick certain times and not other times. And guides are humans and we have to, you know, check in with one another and keep each other healthy. And, you know, that's really the team's social net. That's really the team's safety net in that way, is that connection between the two or three or more guides that are working together.
One of the cool things about the expedition guiding is that you typically are working with a team of guides, and most of the other guiding I do anywhere else, it's probably just me and one or two or three clients that I'm with. And so it's kind of a unique experience almost in the guiding world to be working with a team like that. And it happens a lot on those high altitude peaks. And maybe you were going to touch on this, but another, one of the real important things about like monitoring each other as within the guide team, but also with the clients and the entire climbing team, is just making sure that you have open communication about how people are feeling so that you can help to address any issues as they come up. And so sort of establishing sort of the culture of the climbing team to be communicating about that stuff and being able to show weakness, I think is really important, because it's easy to, you know, people will come into the kitchen tent in the morning for breakfast and just be like, I feel great and I feel super strong and let's get ready to go today. And if I'm like, well, I have a little bit of a headache this morning and I don't feel that great and I'm a little tired from yesterday, and just changing that conversation and the sort of permission structure to say, yeah, actually I didn't sleep that well either and I don't feel that great. And it's like, okay, like let's have that conversation. Instead of putting on the facade of like the indestructible mountain guide who never, you know, feels bad and I'm just going to keep going, like let's all just talk about how we're feeling. Cause then you can make changes. You can say, okay, well, let's like have a lighter load today, or maybe we'll take an extra day, and really set you up for success. But I think a lot of times that is one of the challenges, is just getting people to be willing to communicate with you about how they really are feeling. And with clients, sometimes they think if they show any weakness that their guide's going to turn them around, you know, like, oh, the guide's going to find out I didn't sleep well and I have a headache and they're going to make me go down. And really what we're trying to do is get the information to use the tools at our disposal to help them succeed ultimately. So that's just a big part of the sort of climbing team culture that I think is important.
Do you think that's changed over the years with guiding, where there is room for some of that vulnerability? Because I feel like that's culturally, in some ways, the direction that we've gone, where there's kind of this tough exterior of we can't really admit weakness, to like, hey, this isn't going so well. Like, have you seen that change throughout either of your careers of being able to have that communication, or is that there from the start?
I think that comes from the confidence that you have by having experience up there. Like, I'm sure the first time I was on Denali, I didn't want anybody to see any weakness. I didn't want to admit that I didn't feel good or that I was tired or anything. But like after years of doing it, I'm not concerned about my ability to be there. And I guess I'm willing to express when things aren't perfect, or willing to admit that I have a headache this morning, or I'm tired from yesterday, or my backpack is heavy, instead of just pretending it's all fine all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Bill, because if you have the street cred that you've already done this a bunch and you're the guide and you're, you know, been doing this for decades and everybody knows you can do it, and if you admit that you're not feeling that great, it's just like, oh, Bill's having an off day. But if you're the unproven guide or the apprentice, or you're the client, you know, you don't have that you don't have that social currency with the rest of the group that you can easily say that. And that is a stigma that exists. And I think we needed to, just like what we're doing here, be aware of it, talk about it in the beginning, and try to just, it's a lot of work as a leader of a team like that. You're just constantly communicating and building trust and observing. And, you know, every guide has a different way of doing it. A lot of people I've seen do it really successfully with sort of humor, by like teasing people, and they build up a little rapport. And, you know, other people do it with like kind of storytelling or, you know, things. But I do think that it just comes down to, you know, basic emotional intelligence and human relationships 101 to create this area of safety for those guides and clients that don't have that social currency of a ton of experience at a high altitude.
that makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad that it's coming up, because I think that that's super key in the mountain world. I think that's something Steve and I have talked a lot about. I'm sure, Bill, you think and talk a lot about, of like, how do you both, you know, be safe through vulnerability in a way. I'm curious too, how do you manage clients' expectations? So say you get a client who's like, Summiter, you know, I've wasted my money. How are you able to take that client and rein them in to a certain extent?
Yeah, that's tough. We try to address that like from the very first conversations we have with people. We try to define like what our goals as a team are for this expedition, and getting to the summit isn't number one. You know, like being safe and having a good experience comes in front of getting to the summit. So, and what we say is like, if you do those first two things right, if you're concentrating on, you know, safety and risk management and having a good experience in terms of like treating each other well and working well as a team, then the third one, the getting to the summit, that falls into place, you know. But if the other parts fall apart, you're not going to get to the summit anyway. So I think it's, you know, we try to communicate that with our clients right off the bat. And then like, if all you're thinking about is the summit, you're not paying attention to what you're doing today. You're not only missing out on some of the joy, but you're probably not doing a very good job of what you're doing today. And so I always try to just like, yes, think about the summit, but we need to break this down into what do I need to accomplish today to get to the summit in a week or two from now, and really focus on doing a good job of that and taking care of each little step along the way.
You know, I think that one thing that I would tell prospective clients is, you know, first of all, the guiding community is freaking amazing. Like, it's just one of the best groups of people that I've ever worked with, interacted with. And that goes across cultures, across just everybody I've known who's been a mountain guide for any length of time is a good person. Like, I think that it just, the profession attracts and frankly selects for honest, hardworking people who have a lot of values. And what I want people to know is that the guides want to get to the summit as much or more than you do. Like, for me, is when I'm guiding, like, it's really important for me that I get my group to the summit. It's all the rest, of course, is important, what Bill was saying, and I'm not going to compromise safety and a quality experience for that summit. But I really want to be successful, because it's a binary thing, right? Like, you invest all this time, all this energy into putting this trip together. And for sure, there's sometimes where it's just outside of your control. It's just like, and Bill and I both had many of these experiences where it's just like, there was, and those are honestly some of the easiest, where it's just like, it's clear that nobody can summit right now. And what's hardest is when it's in between, when it's like, maybe some people are sneaking up there and they're getting some little windows and they're getting lucky, and you get, and your team is like pushing you. And, you know, I just want climbers that are climbing with guides to know that those guides are driving themselves just as hard as you're driving them, if not harder. They really want to get you to the top. They really want that, not just for you, but also for themselves, for their company, for their sense of purpose, their sense of pride, their sense of a job well done, all of those things. And these people are really hardworking, good, accountable, like honest people, down to every last one of them that I've ever met. So I just think that that's really important for people to keep in mind when they're talking to any kind of, if you're talking to a guide about Denali or Everest, I mean, these are not going to be people who have never guided a mountain before, right? These are going to be people who have worked their way up. And so they're, you're already talking to like a very solid, you know, sliver of the population that is going to, you know, stick by what they say, and they're going to do everything they can to make it a success.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see clients make when they're in high altitude situations? It seems like staying in your tent alone is one of the big ones. What are a few others that you see?
Back to just kind of the food and water, just like the basic fueling and hydrating. And people, it takes discipline to do that. You're not necessarily going to be hungry or thirsty, but you need to remain disciplined to take care of yourself in that way. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's pushing too hard. Like people get to camp and they're feeling good and they're like at high camp and it's almost they're elated and they drop their packs and they're like, I don't feel crappy up here. This is awesome. Let's set up tents. I'm going to start digging snow and shoveling and building blocks and building snow walls and just go until they're like, oh, all of a sudden they're bonking and feeling like crap. And then it can be really hard to recover, you know, from that. And so like just pacing yourself and pacing your energy, not just when you're climbing, but when you get to camp also, and all the work that needs to be done there, because it's really hard to recover once you push yourself too deep. And I did that to myself moving up. It was on Everest and I was feeling so good moving up to camp two. And some of the Sherpas that I knew that were working with us were passing me. And I was like, oh, I'm going to keep up with these guys today. And I could do it, but I paid the price, I felt like, for 2 days after that, just because I got there and didn't feel like I should have. And it took me days to recover because I just pushed just 10% too hard for a few hours one day, you know, so.
Yeah, that all comes with experience. And it's my recommendation would be to just ask the people that are more experienced. And because there's a lot of these things where you just aren't going to know. And it's okay not to know. You've never done this before. But that part of the reason the guiding team is there is to help you through all of those questions and doubts. And a good guide is not going to mind at all answering all your questions. And they're actually going to embrace each one as a potential way to educate the whole team, to make the whole team come together, to share knowledge. They're going to be positively motivated by those kind of questions. So I'd say, you know, don't be afraid to ask questions. And the other thing that I'd say is, I think one of the biggest mistakes, it can be not doing a good job with interpersonal dynamics. I think that this is something that I think actually we've been working to, I don't know if address, but we've been working to help with Uphill Athlete, with our memberships and other, and also with our coached athletes that are training for the same objective, and getting them in contact with one another so that they can start to get to know one another before the trip. And we've also had groups where the whole group trains together for a particular expedition. And they're like sharing notes on their training, and they're doing some Zoom calls about, you know, training subjects and stuff. And they get to see each other's faces. They get to go get in a chat group and, you know, share pictures of their dogs while they're hiking or whatever it is, right? And the interpersonal dynamics on an expedition are really important. And if you just show up at a hotel in Anchorage or Kathmandu one day and you meet like eight new strangers that you're going to, you know, be spending 24 hours a day for 7 days a week for 3 to 6 weeks, you know, that's tough. That's tough. Like I don't excel in that situation. I have a hard time in that situation, and most of us do. So trying to put energy into making that as good as you can and contribute to that being a positive experience for everyone, and being tolerant of people because everybody's going to get on each other's nerves at some point, not get clicky, not get like, that's another mistake where people form these little packs within the expedition, and that has massive negative impacts. And it's of course up to the guides to kind of monitor and encourage the right culture within a trip. And it sounds funny to say culture when you have a 3-week trip, but you know, that really happens. Like you have trips where the group just gels and works really well together and is super strong. And you have trips, and I know Bill is nodding his head over there, like has the same experience where they're just like the group fractures and it never kind of comes together. And that is really, really important, not just to the safety and the quality of the experience, but also to the success, because people just get demotivated when they're not having fun with people they don't really care for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've definitely had a couple of clients actually come back from trips and be like, I just did not like the group and it didn't go super well. So it is really interesting. Like that's a huge factor in their experience is like, I didn't like my tent mate. I felt really isolated. Yeah. So no, that's a huge piece.
And I'm sure Bill and I have both had those trips where there's that one person that honestly nobody likes. and it's really tough because, you know, it's like, man, this person is a real jerk, and not just to me, but to everybody else. And it ruins the whole vibe. And there's really not a whole lot you can do other than try to get to know people beforehand. This is like my standard advice when people come to me asking like, who should I climb Denali with or who should I climb Everest with? I always tell them like, find a guide that is doing those trips, get to know them, do some other climbing with them. You might not jive with them, and you know, don't just sign up based on, you know, I don't know how nice the website is or something like that, but actually get to know the people, because that's what's going to get you up there.
Yeah, luckily those kind of toxic personalities are pretty few and far between, I feel like. The people that actually want to come and do these types of trips, like generally understand that it's a teamwork thing. And there's some really, like you mentioned before, like really interesting, amazing, motivated, driven, hardworking, really cool people that come to do these things. And then occasionally you'll get that sort of toxic personality that can really bring the whole team down. We've been doing for a while now is we'll do these pre-trip Zoom meetings, like a couple of months prior to the trip, and the whole team gets together with the guides and has this meeting on Zoom and begins this communication months before the expedition. And I sometimes catch little threads of emails or text messages, and you start to see these groups that really do come together before they've ever met in person. And they're like, yeah, I was out training today and I was doing this. And by the time they get to the mountain, then if somebody's having a bad day and they're, you know, they're just struggling and can't put their tent up, well, these other people, they're already like, they're a team, and they're like going to go over and help that person out. And instead of looking at them going, who's this person? They can't even put their tent up. Why are they here? You know, kind of thing. So, that culture and that teamwork, I think it's really a neat part of the expedition experience, is working with a team of people who come from different parts of the world and different backgrounds, who all have this similar goal and are coming together to work really hard together and support each other on this journey. And it's like, kind of sounds cliche, but that's really, as a guide, that's, you know, part of the reward, or one of the more rewarding parts of the job, is kind of seeing these groups of people come together and achieve things that are hard to do and require a lot of suffering and sacrifice along the way. And seeing people do that together is pretty neat. Mm-hmm.
It's giving a lot of flashbacks, honestly, to being a teacher in a classroom. It's very similar of like getting a group of, so there's sometimes a rotten egg, but when you get them all working together in collaboration, it's a pretty beautiful thing to see what they can accomplish. So this is kind of a last fun question, because as teaching high school students can be and is very exhausting, guiding sounds extremely exhausting when you come back from a trip. What's your favorite way to kick back, or like first meal you want when you're back in civilization?
Probably a cheeseburger and fries. Like that's kind of nice. The classic. Yeah, just about anywhere in the world you can find that. And
I'll add I would add a beer to that menu, but other than that,
yes, and probably ice cream at the end,
and then probably ice cream. Yeah, I remember one of my early trips, or one of my early experiences in Alaska was probably like 20. I would have been 25, and I guided a West Buttress trip, and then I guided a West Rib trip. And then I went on in back in and did a personal climbing trip, and I kept a journal and I was making all kinds of notes in my journal. But what I realized months later was that in the days that I had been in Talkeetna between these different trips, I had averaged over 3 pints of Haagen-Dazs per day. So, I mean, part of it's the downtime, right? But part of it is just like, you know, you need to eat. Like you've been working really hard. You've been at high altitude. Your body's craving calories because you're just in a calorie deficit and you just need to eat. So yeah, why not some good ice cream?
I mean, that's the metric the people want, Steve. But also, yeah, when you were saying like sleeping at 14,000+, all I can think of is that is so many calories just existing and staying alive.
It is.
Yeah, let alone working. Well, thank you both so much for joining me on this episode. And Bill, I'd love to have you tell our listeners how they can find more about Mountain Trip and connect with you, see about getting on one of your expeditions or trips.
Yeah. We actually have a website called mountaintrip.com. And we, so recently, just the last couple of years, it's kind of been a passion project is we're building this new website called Summit Denali, which has been more, it's trying to just be an educational website, and we can't help but approach everything in there from our perspective, which is as guides, but it's a new website that people can look at. That's it's specifically just for Denali and Alaska Range stuff. And we've tried to include more articles that would be appropriate for private climbers that aren't necessarily coming with a guide. So like, how do you manage your kitchen and your stoves and your food packing and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's us, Mountain Trip.
Awesome. I will link that in the show notes, and also the Climb Denali. Was the other website?
Summit Denali. Yeah.
Summit Denali. Wow. Messed it up right off the bat. There was two things to remember. Awesome. Well, thank you both. And thank you for listening to the Uphill Athlete podcast. If you could rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, that helps us to help more athletes be their best at any altitude. Steve, do you want to wrap us up?
It's not just one, but a community. Together, we are Uphill Athlete. Thanks, Bill, for coming on.